next met with Dr. Cliff Huddis, also our incoming ASCO president. And to begin, I followed up my second opinion conversation with Dr. Miller and asked Dr. Huddis what the most common situations were where his perspective is different than the first or referring oncologist's.
I can give you three right off the bat. The first is anytime we recommend old-fashioned CMF for low-risk breast cancer, most of the world doesn't love CMF right now. The second is anytime that somebody's been told that they should not get Adriamycin and we recommend its use. And then the third, which I think is a little bit more in evolution, but I think, and you and I have probably spoken about this in the past, but I would say that we are getting increasingly comfortable with the idea that you might not recommend chemotherapy even in the face of node-positive breast cancer on the basis of, for example, a low oncotype score. I think that's the place where the community, you know, every time I get a consult about that, and that's an example of one I got by email a few weeks ago, a guy wrote to me and said his breast surgeon told him that a 65-year-old with an oncotype score of 8 and a single positive node really might not need chemo, and he was sort of in shock at that concept. And I ended up in a back-and-forth exchange. He's a good guy, saying, you know, when you really start to think about the node negative data and you start to think about the responder trial and you start to think about biology versus anatomy, I think that while you're technically right with standard of care in 2012, I think you need to be seeing a near horizon where that's in evolution.
And the responder trial you're talking about, of course, is an intergroup study, 1 to 3 positive node patients.
The broader issue is we give tamoxifen or an aromatase inhibitor because a target is present and a biology is present. And ditto for trastuzumab or lapatinib and HER2. So the idea that all tumors are equivalently sensitive to chemotherapy flies in the face of reason. We know it's not true. And the extremes are the ones that make it easy. So if I describe to you a woman with an invasive lobular cancer, 100% ER and PR, HER2 negative, and 15 positive lymph nodes, while the convention is to give chemotherapy, I don't think anybody believes any longer that that's the important part of her curative therapy. It's hormone therapy. So let me point out what this means. This means that you can have high-risk disease that is not sensitive to hormone therapy, just like you don't give trastuzumab because there are 15 involved nodes, and you don't give tamoxifen because there are 15 involved nodes. You give them because their target's there. So what that means in turn is that the Oncotype DX and other tests to follow, maybe PAM50 and others, ultimately will have as their ideal or optimal function the identification, in my opinion, of tumors that are sensitive to a specific therapy, i.e. chemo. And once you accept that, which you kind of have in the node negative setting, the responder trial, which takes these lower risk but node positive patients and performs the test and then randomizes the lower risk ones to get chemo or not, is just incrementally moving us along to recognize that anatomy is perhaps destiny, but it is not predictive of a drug sensitivity. That's the point.
And, you know, I can understand that this is a concept in evolution and it might create some conflicts. But just getting back to the first two things that you were mentioning, what situations nowadays are you using CMF? And I think I saw a paper you all put together in terms of the issue of anthracyclines. What's your thought right now, both in HER2 negative, HER2 positive, in terms of anthracyclines?
The Oncotype test in its node negative setting was used to adjudicate the value of adding CMF to hormone therapy, specifically tamoxifen. So in cases where I'm using an Oncotype in node-negative breast cancer to decide whether or not to give chemotherapy, almost all the time that leads me to CMF, because if a case is so borderline, in my opinion, for whether it needs chemotherapy or not, I have a hard time turning around and arguing that differences in the chemotherapy regimen will subsequently matter a lot.
And just out of curiosity, what specific CMF regimen?
We're still giving it, and I'll come back to this, intravenously at 640, 600 each per meter squared, 8 cycles at traditionally 3-week intervals. However, we've published the feasibility of giving it at 2-week intervals, and we actually published the feasibility of giving it at 10 to 11 days, and all of which just means that while we don't have randomized data for Q2-week therapy in terms of efficacy, we have very ample data for feasibility. And so we can offer this in 16 weeks to people who just want to get it done. And a good bit of the time we'll do that. I know it's not evidence-based. Don't string me up.
So just to clarify, I'm guessing you don't use TC or AC.
Well, I don't use AC alone ever as a standard option. If I'm going to give the anthracycline-inducing alopecia, I'm going to also give the taxane. Let me back up, make one other point for you. AC at 3-week intervals times 4 has been shown to be equivalent to oral CMF, certainly in the past. So there really isn't any argument for picking one or the other on the efficacy side.
But I would assume it's a lot more tolerable to get CMF.
Well, that's exactly the point. It takes longer, but it's acutely more tolerable, and you don't have, with the IV, there's really no alopecia. So that's one thing. And the TC, you know, there is, of course, Jones et al., the TC is superior to AC result. And if I were to ever want to use AC alone, then I probably would give TC. But I, like I just said, really don't do that. And how TC would stack up to a sequential regimen of AC, then a taxane, of course, is not directly addressed. Indirectly, I'd say the available evidence is not so reassuring. The 8 cycles versus 4 NSABP studies showed that AC followed by full dose docetaxel was superior to AT or TAC. And TAC is TC plus Adria, essentially. So I think it's pretty unlikely that the sequential 8-cycle regimens are not superior to TC. So once I'm giving the taxane, giving the alopecia, in those cases, I generally would go ahead and give the sequential regimen.
So when you recommend, you say that sometimes there's a difference in viewpoint in terms of whether to use anthracyclines that you see.
Well, I think there are a couple of things to point out. The first is that the anthracyclines have a massive track record, and globally, not AC specifically, but globally, the use of anthracyclines, epi, Adria, 6 cycles, as component parts of the sequential plan, are generally associated with superiority, and that's shown in the Oxford overview as well as in individual trials. 2, with regard to the HER2 subset, of course, in the pre-trastuzumab era, there was some evidence that the anthracyclines made a difference. I think it's reasonable to ask whether that's still applicable in the post-trastuzumab era. The problem is that the only data we have, of course, is from the BCRG trial, which, of course, has recently been published and introduces its own set of issues. I'll highlight one of them. Very much is made in the ACT with H study versus TCH comparison. That comparison, of course, was not set up in the trial. Each of the trastuzumab-containing regimens was being compared to a control of ACT. When one drills down on this toxicity issue, and there are tables in the New England Journal paper you can go and look at, I draw everybody's attention to the following. 1, no cardiac deaths reported. 2, more deaths reported on the TCH arm than on the ACTH arm. That's a fact. 3, more cases of congestive heart failure on the ACTH arm as compared to TCH. That's a fact. But those two deltas are actually about the same. And so there's a kind of, in my opinion, artificial equivalence being set up here between roughly, I'm rounding off, 20 more cases of heart failure, no cardiac deaths, versus 20 more deaths from breast cancer. To me, they're not equivalent. If you forced me to pick right now, I'd rather take a few more cases of heart failure and a few less numbers of deaths. And that's where the data is right now. But this has been made in the community's mind sort of an equivalent issue, and I don't get it.
So Kathy, after the interview, seeing that I was interested in this, sent me several cases she reviewed, but she didn't say what she recommended. And I asked her if it was okay with her to present those to you.
Okay.
So let's begin. 37-year-old woman with locally advanced ER-positive, HER2-positive disease 3 years ago. Gets neoadjuvant ACTH followed by tamoxifen and now has an isolated chest wall nodule, 0.5 centimeters, resected with clear margins, now being radiated. Path is ER positive, HER2 positive, no evidence of distant disease on a workup. What do I do with systemic treatment?
Yeah, it's a brutal case.
But, you know, getting back to these, you know, these things happen and there's no, you know, evidence base for what to do. But
and she's had a mastectomy.
It seems like it, yeah.
Because it's a chest wall nodule, right?
Yes.
So there are a couple layers of thought process here. The first is when we see this kind of a case, we carefully examine the pathology because not only are we looking to confirm the histology of the tumor, but we're really desperately looking for evidence of preserved duct epithelium in the chest wall and or duct carcinoma in situ. Because if we see that, we can make a plausible argument that this isn't really a metastasis to the skin so much as a new primary in a high-risk person. And that has a lot to do with the defensibility of our next steps, because if there's any chance that it's really a new primary rather than a recurrence or a metastasis, in that case, one would treat aggressively for cure, one would radiate as they have, one would give another course of trastuzumab for a year, in my opinion, and one would give another course of chemotherapy of some sort. In this kind of a case, if she doesn't have neuropathy, I might give weekly paclitaxel with the trastuzumab, or I might even give CMF in a case like this where she's had the anthracycline and the taxane and if she couldn't tolerate more of the taxane. But that's one approach. And of course, I would change her hormone therapy. If she had been on tamoxifen, I would ablate her ovarian function at this point and give her an AI. Now, conversely, it gets a little trickier if this is really provably a MET. And I have to say that we bend over backwards to call this kind of a case a new primary if we can get away with it. But if one could confirm that this was really a metastasis. Let's say there's no duct epithelium and the nodule's grown through the skin. It's really a chest wall metastasis. In that case, the evidence-based answer is obviously lacking, but the conservative approach might be to radiate her and watch her and wait for something to treat, because what she needs in that case, unfortunately, is palliative therapy. If you wanted to be aggressive about it, and I probably would, I would certainly change hormone therapy in that case. And I would struggle quite a bit with re-adding the trastuzumab. I would not give lapatinib because I think its toxicities in this kind of an NED situation would be hard to justify.
This also kind of brings up the question of if and when pertuzumab is available, would that fit into the treatment of a patient like this?
Well, you know,
assuming you
I think you have
it.
To back into it differently. Let's make it exactly what you said, but it's inoperable.
Mm-hmm.
In that case, it's going to be the first-line therapy, of course, for patients who are getting a taxane and trastuzumab.
Just as long as we're talking about it, what are your thoughts about the CLEOPATRA data that were presented? And again, I mean, I don't know, maybe you know, I don't know if and when the drug is going to become available. How do you see using it?
So with regard to CLEOPATRA, first of all, I'm impressed by how positive the trial is. And I think that it's likely that they will get, obviously, get an indication for it exactly as tested there. And so I think that will become very quickly standard first-line therapy for metastatic breast cancer that's HER2 positive. I don't see a way around it. The toxicities were nominal. The 50% improvement in progression-free survival was striking. And the likelihood of a very significant improvement in overall survival was raised, obviously, in the preliminary numbers, and they're small in terms of events, but 96 becoming 69 deaths at the first look, if I remember correctly. I don't see any reason not to give it.
What about in second line and beyond in a patient who's never had it?
Well, that's going to be a challenge because obviously it won't be inexpensive, and I suspect that insurers and others are going to get ever more clear in terms of approving drugs as indicated because of their expense. I think we're going to see some interesting discussions. My suspicion is that there'll be a wave of people who are getting it at times of progression, second, third, even higher, and that'll pass for a while.
Right.
In the meantime, they'll do some studies to demonstrate potentially activity in those settings. But I think their big push, obviously, is earlier. The adjuvant affinity trial is already opening, obviously. On our service, we have a non-randomized phase 2 of pertuzumab, trastuzumab with weekly paclitaxel, because we recognize that obviously many American clinicians and others may actually ultimately prefer weekly paclitaxel as the partner here. And we want to just demonstrate feasibility and get a point estimate for PFS. If it looks anything like the experimental arm of CLEOPATRA, I think it'll be pretty reassuring that that's a reasonable substitution.
I always really liked that New England Journal review paper you did on trastuzumab. And of course, they have such great artists there. Remember the mechanism of action graphic. Do you want to take a shot at explaining again how pertuzumab works and, for that matter, how trastuzumab works?
Yeah. So trastuzumab binds to the external portion of HER2 in an area that is low near the cell surface. The dimerization domain for HER2 is up higher. Picture a tree trunk. Trastuzumab is binding to the fat trunk down near the ground, but the leaves are the area where the dimerization occurs with other receptors. So if you stick trastuzumab on the trunk, it actually does not mechanically impede dimerization, although many imagine that that might be its role. So the role of trastuzumab to start with, you know, is speculative, although I have my pet. So one theory was that it simply binds there, prevents dimerization. We've knocked that out. The second is that it binds there and prevents cleavage of the extracellular domain so that you don't generate the so-called P95 remnant, which autonomously would signal. You know, that's like it prevents the tree trunk from being sawed off. And the idea would be that the little remnant of the trunk and the roots would somehow autonomously signal. That's the P95. Now, there is P95, and that's another whole complex story. A third possibility is that it causes endocytosis, downregulation of the receptor. And interestingly enough, that's thought to maybe be part of the mechanism of action for T-DM1, which after all is trastuzumab with the linked maytansine. And the idea there is that there's endocytosis, evagination of the receptor complex to the antibody. In the case of T-DM1, that is internalized in the cell. The cleavage is broken between the chemotherapy delivering it intracellularly and making a relatively toxic drug tolerable. But the fourth mechanism, and the one that in some ways is most appealing given what we know clinically about trastuzumab, is the possibility that trastuzumab actually induces ADCC. And that's attractive because it's the easiest explanation for the clinical activity of trastuzumab even in patients who've had progression. Because if you go with a mechanistic description, as I just did, of trastuzumab efficacy, then you have a hard time explaining tumors that grow on it and yet do better when you continue it. But ADCC could allow you to explain that. So the pertuzumab is distinct from trastuzumab because it binds the upper portion of the receptor, that is, the part up in the leaves. And so that introduces a couple of concepts. The first is it actually binds the dimerization domain, so it may well be a dimerization inhibitor. It may also do ADCC. I mean, you know, all bets are off, but that's one thing. Two, you can use both antibodies at the same time. Even though they're both targeting HER2, they're targeting distinctly separate regions of it, so there's no evidence of any interference. And that's been shown now in multiple phase 1 and 2 studies, so that part's resolved. And three, pertuzumab's development was broader at first than HER2 because this dimerization targeting, in theory, could mean that it would be like a pan-HER inhibitor. In practice, its efficacy seems to be limited really to HER2-positive disease. So that's the story.
Okay, here's another one. Mother of a Hodgkin patient from the same practice treated with breast-conserving surgery, RT, and AI, for ER-positive DCIS 2 years ago. Now, in breast recurrence, 1.8 centimeter ER-positive, HER2-positive disease, completion mastectomy, one positive node. What to do with her hormonal therapy post-chemo?
Yeah, so in this case, I would switch this patient to tamoxifen. But that's just seat of the pants, and it's because she had this happen on the AI.
You know, I was really struck by this case, and I was kind of curious. I mean, how many people are out there, for example, in your practice, have you seen cases where people, you know, start out with, I mean, obviously it happens according to the numbers, but with DCIS who die of breast cancer?
Well, it's always been quoted at something like up to 1%. Yesterday, I saw somebody who had a microinvasive DCIS about 2 years ago, and basically had a lumpectomy and RT and declined any systemic therapy, just wouldn't do it. She was young, and she came back in now with a 2 foci of invasive cancer and is now getting, you know, real chemo and hormone therapy.
The thing that struck me about this case is I was thinking about that presentation at San Antonio by Dr. Larry Solon, looking at, we were talking before about Oncotype, but Oncotype and DCIS. Can you talk about that and also just in general, what other sort of genomic biologic work we have on DCIS?
Well, I can only really talk about in terms of the genomic work on DCIS. I can talk a little bit about Larry Solon's presentation. So they took a subset of the 21 gene test that we know as the Oncotype, and I think they only have 16 genes. So 5 reference genes and 11 genes out of the original 16. And what they showed is that they have a prognosticator. So they can take DCIS and they can draw a curve and they can make a prediction of the likelihood of an in-breast event over the coming years. So it's like the first report of the oncotype in invasive breast cancer. It's a prognostic tool. The problem is, and it's not a small problem, is that they don't have randomized data for the radiation therapy. So there is an assumption that below some number, the risk is so low, based upon the oncotype, that you would be willing to forego radiation. But that's not completely agreed upon by everybody right now. And so that's where this sits.
Do you see, I think that this assay you can actually order, do you see any role for it right now?
I think it's an evolution, but I think that it needs more data. I think the key issue, and we were very lucky that we were able to do this with the oncotype, is that we converted it in practice from a prognostic test to a predictive test.
Right.
And to me, that's where the money is. That's what ER is good for, and that's what HER2 is good for. And I think that the same thing really needs to happen here.
All right, here's our third case. Patient with low-risk ER-negative disease getting adjuvant TC, rash after cycle 1, proceeded to cycle 2, admitted to the hospital with severe skin toxicity near Stevens-Johnson's reaction. Yeah. Recovered and would be due for cycle 3 tomorrow. Now what?
Yeah. So this is a good reason to like CMF. Allergies can happen with anything, including methotrexate. But if this patient has sufficiently high-risk disease to warrant therapy, and two cycles of TC have rendered TC intolerable, this is the kind of case where I might turn around and give her CMF.
Why would you want to give her cyclophosphamide again?
Well, because of I would think it's probably related to the taxane. Probably what I would do here is maybe give one dose of Adriamycin as a single agent, mirroring, 9741, where we showed that sequential single agents were the same. And I might actually just give her that and then methotrexate fluorouracil. I mean, this is a very tough case because obviously you're halfway through an adjuvant chemo regimen. You don't have the ability to fall back on hormone therapy that could be useful, but she's inadequately treated. So I'd give her some portion of a standard other regimen.
I want to maybe spend the last few minutes just talking about some assorted developments that have happened in the recent months. And one I wanted to ask you about is everolimus, the so-called Belera 2 trial. Obviously, that was presented and published. And I mean, the drug's out there. I don't know. Are people actually getting permission to use it?
For sure.
Really? Interesting. So have you used it?
Yep.
Can you talk a little bit more about the trial itself and what you think it meant?
Well, of course, the trial took patients with hormone receptor positive breast cancer, interestingly, not selected for abnormalities in the PI3 kinase pathway at all, and randomized them to get exemestane alone or with the mTOR inhibitor, everolimus, which, of course, is already available and in the market. This is important for other indications like renal cell cancer. And in that study, those patients who got everolimus added to the exemestane, which was being given on label, those patients had a prolonged progression-free survival, no impact on overall survival, and by report, a moderate increase in toxicity. I say it that way because in the clinic, when one uses the drug, both the nature and pattern of the toxicities that one sees are a little bit different than, I think, what breast cancer doctors are used to. For example, people have a fair bit of mucositis and change in taste perception. Many patients can't tolerate the full dose, and you have to stop it. And then when they feel a little better, you can resume it at a lower dose. And this change in taste, by the way, is persistent throughout the period of treatment. Some people have some low counts and certainly fatigue. So this drug, while not being classically called chemotherapy, has a great deal in common, certainly with some kinds of mild chemotherapy agents.
Just a couple of follow-up questions. One investigator, Sarah Hurwitz, told me a kind of interesting, weird story. I'm curious if you heard about it, of people giving the drug with a dollop of whipped cream to sort of keep it away from the tongue. Have you ever heard of that?
Nope.
Nobody has. Anyhow.
I'm going to try it.
Yeah, I mean, it's like not completely non-intuitive, She claims that it makes a difference. And then what about the pneumonitis?
Yeah, I haven't seen that yet, and I don't know how common that actually is. I saw that there was mention of it. But
in what situations do you think it makes sense to use the drug right now?
Well, I think that's a very challenging question. I've had a couple of patients aware of the data who've asked about it. let me back into it. It doesn't yet appear to have an impact on overall survival. And while that's not the only criteria that matters, for an expensive drug with toxicities, I think it's a factor. And so my motivation for it would be higher still if one demonstrated an impact on overall survival. That may come, that may not, we'll see. I have given it to a couple of people who have progressive disease and were ready to start exemestane and were willing to put up with the increase in toxicities now to forestall what looks to be inevitable chemotherapy later.
And do you see this agent working its way into the adjuvant setting?
There are proposals for adjuvant trials already. I think that they will have some obvious challenges given the toxicity profile.
Well, also the question of, do you think that the benefit is going to be restricted to people who sort of develop resistance to hormonal therapy or primary hormonal therapy?
Right. I understand. And I think that's something that remains to be seen. It could go the other way, that you'll see a benefit in the adjuvant setting because you'll prevent the emergence of that resistance.
One other thing I want to ask you about is, I guess we're hoping to see some data from the now closed CALGB metastatic trial that Hope Rugo is running, looking at, well, I was going to ask you to talk about the design about that and what you're looking forward to seeing in terms of data.
So I know the data.
Okay. Is it going to be presented at ASCO?
Yes.
That's what I figured. Is there anything that you can say about it?
Let me frame it out this way. I think it's an important study. The comparison is between weekly paclitaxel, the control group, and independently each of the experimental arms. So last summer, and this was announced, we closed the study for a little while because we crossed a futility boundary, and I want to be crystal clear about this. In that analysis, it became clear that under no conditions in the study would the ixepepilone ever be superior to weekly paclitaxel for efficacy, which was progression-free survival. That was our primary endpoint. And so I'm not saying it's worse. Let me make sure we're really clear here. What I'm saying is, powered for superiority, this study, which was originally planning to accrue around 900 patients on a one-to-one-to-one basis, we crossed a boundary that said we would never show ixepepilone to be superior. Given that, and given the differential toxicities that were being reported, our DSMB advised us to stop that study. So we stopped it. We amended the trial through the end of the summer, and we reopened to finish the remaining arm, which was the albumin-bound paclitaxel versus paclitaxel. It's worth also emphasizing that while it's not a point of the study, most of the patients in this trial, maybe all, I'm not sure, but most received bevacizumab. That was not a random assignment. That was just as we thought standard practice would be. And by the way, notwithstanding what happened with Bev, our accrual has only gone up in the last year to this study. So we reopened it, and then we closed it again in November. Again, basically the same kind of a pronouncement from our DSMB that the albumin-bound paclitaxel, using, by the way, 3 weeks on, 1 week off, weekly, so-called weekly administration for each of the agents, that it could not be superior.
So one of the issues that seemed like would be interesting, particularly in the NAB arm, would be the toxicity neuropathy.
Yeah, all that is coming.
Now, you were one of the authors on a paper in San Antonio, Andy Simon, first author, randomized phase 2 trial, weekly versus Q2 weekly versus Q3 NAB with Bev.
And that's submitted for publication.
What about NAB? Is there any advantage to it? What are your thoughts about it? Where is it heading?
Well, I mean, I think people, unfortunately, are going to have to wait for June and see what Hope has to say. In the metastatic setting as palliative therapy, I think that there's a story there, and we'll have to see what it is, and we'll have to make our, you know, judgments about that. I think in the adjuvant setting, there's no plan that I know of for a definitive phase 3 trial to establish its role. So I think that it's probably going to continue to be as it's been, which is to say, in some practices, it's the first choice because of the convenience and lack of pre-medication and so forth. And in other practices, it's going to be restricted because of the cost.
What do you think would have happened or would be happening right now if, you know, sort of NAB were generic or whatever, there wasn't a cost issue?
Well, I think if there's not a cost issue, then people would be focusing even more finely on the real toxicity differences for the patient, because that would be the defining factor, I think.
I'm going to just close out asking you, we were talking in the beginning about second opinions and all the interactions that you have with docs in practice. What are some of the common questions that they ask you that we haven't talked about today?
Let me think for a minute. I'm going to just rattle off the ones I frequently get. One is, what do you do after 5 years of aromatase inhibitor therapy in the adjuvant setting?
That's a good one. What are you doing?
Well, we're waiting, holding our breath for the randomized trial that addresses that. But I will say that the standard answer, the guidelines answer, has to be that you stop at 5 years. That's all there is. But for the occasional very high-risk patient who's anxious about stopping and feels well on the drug, I'm not opposed to continuing it while we wait.
Okay, what else?
I think a second issue, which we have touched on, I'm just running them off, is the anthracycline issue that comes up constantly. We spoke about that. I think ovarian ablation for young women remains a topic of some discussion. And we're waiting for the SOFT trial to answer that question finally, I hope. The bisphosphonates in the adjuvant setting remain a hot topic.
Yeah, that's actually the last thing I was going to ask you about was bisphosphonates.
I think, the issue is, unfortunately, that in the chemotherapy-treated population, there is no study where the primary endpoint of superiority from a breast cancer perspective has been met in the adjuvant setting, in terms of survival for sure, and even in the modern era in terms of PFS. And so we have these subsets that could be construed as consistent, that the low estrogen groups seem to be benefiting. And it's not just the postmenopausals in AZUR or the NSABP, but frankly, it's also in that study that, in a way, the ABCSG trial, which does suggest a survival advantage for zoledronic acid, those are women who've not had chemo, by and large, who have ovarian ablation and have had either anastrozole or tamoxifen. You remember that
trial. That was the Austrian study.
Yeah, I'm sort of impressed by that survival difference. But all of that said, the data just isn't compelling right now that there is a significant or substantial improvement in outcomes for the patients with good bone health. And so we continue to use the drug following the bone health guidelines and not based on breast cancer in the adjuvant setting.
Just sort of related to that, when the Austrian data were presented, people were saying, well, in the United States, premenopausal women always get chemo. But I'm not sure now. It seems like with the adoption of Oncotype that there are a fair number of premenopausal women with low recurrence scores who aren't getting chemo. How do you think through their hormonal therapy?
Well, I think that for people who don't get chemo and are premenopausal, I think you do have to think about ovarian suppression. We knew for years that ovarian suppression with tamoxifen was equivalent, at least, to CMF. There was randomized data for that. And so when I see a young person who I'm not giving chemo to for, invasive breast cancer, I typically do offer ovarian suppression and tamoxifen. The choice of tamoxifen is in part based, again, on that same Austrian trial where, despite preconceived notions, the aromatase inhibitor was not superior to tamoxifen for them and may have been inferior.